Hello, I'm Dr. Ann West, bringing you truth from the source. If you've just joined us today for the first time, stay tuned. There's probably something especially for you to hear. Every week, I share with you progressive information to assist those of us who are willing to be a part of the world's solutions and not a part of the problem. So stay with us and share in the alternative ways to heal yourself and your world around you. Welcome to Truth from the Source. Well, this show is part 5 of a series on Truth from the Source called Keepers of the Sea and Their Call for Help. I'm your host, Dr. Ann West. Today's show is concerning the well-being of all marine life in our Hawaiian waters. Dolphins and whales are at grave risk of becoming totally disoriented and separated from their young, resulting in the possible death of calves, experiencing internal bleeding and burst eardrums, or death. This is due to the Navy's intention to start sonar testing in Hawaii waters tomorrow. When this was done 2 years ago, July 3, 2004, over 150 melonhead whales were stranded in Hanalei Bay on Kauai for 28 hours, resulting in the Hanalei Canoe Club, along with other members of the public, assisting the whales back into deeper ocean. A recent report done by NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administrations, identified RIMPAC, that's the Navy's sonar project, as the plausible, if not likely, cause of the strandings. The Navy have not done an environmental impact study on the results of their sonar, even though they had disastrous results from their last exercises in the exact same area. I urge you to stay tuned to this series of shows that I'll be sharing with you in the upcoming weeks, where I'll be continuing interviewing the world's leading experts on this issue. This week's guest is Kara Horowitz. She is a lead project attorney for the NRDC. She works out of the LA office, and her work focuses on the protection of marine mammals through international advocacy and enforcement of domestic laws, including the Marine Mammal Protection Act. She's a graduate of Yale College and UCLA School of Law. We'll be right back with Kara after a message from Pierce Brosnan and NRDC.org.
The ocean is a world of sound. In the darkness of the sea, whales, dolphins, and other marine animals use sound to navigate while migrating, to locate each other over great distances for mating, to find food, avoid predators, and care for their young. Human technology is now drastically changing this environment, damaging a delicate web of life, threatening the ability of whales and other marine animals to function, and ultimately, to survive. High-intensity sonar used by the U.S. and other navies to locate submarines can emit sounds over 235 decibels. As loud as a rocket blasting off. Air guns used for offshore oil and gas exploration emit intense noise bursts that can cover thousands of square miles. Imagine a day in the city, disrupted by excruciating sound. Sounds so loud, they disorient you, paralyzing your ability to function. As we industrialize the marine environment, we are destroying life. Bahamas, March 2000. A U.S. Navy ship blasts high-intensity sonar during training. 16 whales strand, bleeding around the ears and brain. The U.S. government report concludes the mass mortality was caused by high-intensity sonar. Beaked whales observed there for years were never seen again. Canary Islands, September 2002. 18 whales of 3 different species die on the beach in the wake of an international sonar exercise. Washington State, May 2003. Scores of porpoises and killer whales panic as a U.S. Navy destroyer uses high-intensity sonar, and dead porpoises later are found along the shore. North Carolina, January 2005. 37 whales of three different species, some bleeding internally, strand and die along the Outer Banks after a U.S. sonar exercise. The death toll continues. Canary Islands, 1985, 1988, 1989, 1991, 2000. Japan, 10 strandings since 1960. Greece, May, 1996. U.S. Virgin Islands, October, Madeira, May, to Brazil, June. Gulf of California, 2000, September, Hawaii, 2000, July, 2004. Whales, dolphins, and other marine animals can be protected with common sense precautions. Put vital habitat off limits to oil exploration and peacetime training with sonar. Avoid areas where whales migrate, feed, and calve. Use listening devices to make sure whales and dolphins are not nearby. Limit high-intensity sound until scientists know more about harm to whales and other marine life. We can ensure our security and meet our energy needs without endangering the wildlife that shares our oceans. Help protect whales, dolphins, and other marine animals from high-intensity sonar and industrial ocean noise. Visit NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, and IFOR, the International Fund for Animal Welfare Online. Make your voice heard.
Well, it's definitely time for us to become a more powerful and committed voice for the cetaceans, for the whales and the dolphins, and to stand up to the powers that be when they're stepping out of integrity with the natural resources and life of our planet. Whales are ancient beings holding the memories in their DNA of time way before man was even around. They deserve respect and a safe place to live. I would like to welcome NRDC attorney Kara Horowitz. Aloha, Kara.
Good to be here.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I know you're in the middle of a lot of busy work right now.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. I want to thank you so much for the great work you've been doing in Hawaii to publicize this cause.
Yes. Well, we've taken it very seriously, and I know we have great reason to. So, Kara, I understand that one of your main strengths in law is the protection of the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Could you please assist us in understanding what this Protection Act really is, what it stands for, and how it's supposed to protect marine life?
Yeah, absolutely. The Marine Mammal Protection Act is really an extraordinary piece of federal legislation. It's one of our mainstay environmental laws in the U.S. It was passed about 30 years ago because Congress was really worried about our marine mammal populations in the United States and decided to take action. It's a very precautionary statute, which means that one of the things that Congress was worried about was that it's very difficult to detect when human activities are harming marine mammals because they're so difficult to study. They spend so much time sort of in the deep recesses of the sea. It's difficult to know sometimes when our actions are having really harmful effects on them.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that the Marine Mammal Protection Act works is, as I said, quite precautionary. Congress decided to enact a complete moratorium on any takes of marine mammals in U.S. waters, which means a complete moratorium on any actions that will harm them, harass them, capture them, or kill them. And only by special permission from our federal environmental agencies can U.S. actors such as the U.S. Navy get around this moratorium.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean then that the Navy have already received this special permission to harass?
Yeah, the Navy has applied for a permit from the National Marine Fisheries Service, or NMFS, to harass and harm marine mammals as part of its RIMPAC 2006 exercise, which is the exercise that's slated to occur beginning tomorrow in Hawaiian waters.
Yes.
It's not yet received the permission. NIMS is expected to publish the authorization perhaps tomorrow or the next day.
So up until this moment, as far as you know, they have not received the permit yet.
That's right. They've not yet received the permit. And I understand that NIMS is negotiating with the Navy sort of up until the last minute about what it will and will not permit as part of RIMPAC 2006.
Do you have any abilities to see what those negotiations are about right now?
No, I really don't. It's between NIMS and the Navy. What we will see tomorrow is a record of decision coming out of the environmental agency. The permit will come with caveats and required mitigation measures. And when the permit is issued tomorrow, NRDC, as well as a host of other environmental groups and watchdog groups, are going to be very carefully scrutinizing that permit to see if sufficient protective measures have been incorporated into it to, in our view, do enough to protect whales, dolphins, and other marine life from the harms of Navy sonar. Unfortunately, the draft permit that NIMS did publish about a month and a half ago was woefully lacking. So unless NIMS significantly beefs up the protective measures in the permit from its draft, I have a feeling we won't be happy tomorrow.
From what I've read in all of the incredible material that NRDC have supplied to us and other sources, the National Marine Fisheries Service, up till this point, have not actually taken any measures to actually to protect the marine mammals when the Navy have stepped out of line. They've not actually slapped their hand or had any litigation measures against them.
Yeah, it's true. The Navy, for many, many years, and against the advice of lots of folks, including the NRDC over many years, conducted its mid-frequency training exercises and, in fact, still conducts most of its training exercises without any permit under the MMPA, which is to say entirely outside the law.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, NIMS never before had a real opportunity to weigh in with mitigation measures and other requirements in the course of permitting. At the same time, it's been no secret that the Navy has been conducting these training exercises in waters throughout the world, including waters around Hawaii, without such authorization. And it's a real mystery to us and to others why NIMS never before stepped in and really required the Navy to get the kind of permitting that's clearly required under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. NRDC and other environmental groups have been writing the Navy letters and, in fact, bringing the Navy to court.
Yes.
Over the last few years to change the Navy's practices in this regard. And I think, and others think, that it's in no small measure because of the growing public pressure on the Navy that the Navy's begun to talk to NIMS and apply for these sorts of permits under the MMPA, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, for its training exercises, which is, of course, a good step. But if they're not going to, you know, follow the letter of the law, and if the permit itself isn't going to protect marine mammals the way that the Marine Mammal Protection Act requires, it's not enough.
No, it's not. Will NRDC be ready to file a lawsuit against the Navy if this National Marine Fisheries permit is given without the regulations that you've already set in place, you've already asked for them to regard?
Yes, we're going to, as I said, we're going to take a look very carefully tomorrow or on Tuesday, whenever the permit's published, at what that permit contains. And we've told both the Navy and the National Marine Fisheries Service that unless the permit is as strong as we think it needs to be to satisfy federal law and protect whales and dolphins, we are going to take them to court over it.
Who will be a part of this litigation? What organizations will be joining NRDC?
Yeah, certainly not us alone. We're being joined by the International Fund for Animal Welfare, or IFAW, which is a fabulous organization, by the Cetacean Society International, another fabulous NGO, and by Jean-Michel Cousteau and his organization, which is called Ocean's Future Society. Cousteau is the son of the legendary undersea explorer and is, in his own right, quite famous, well-known for his incredible advocacy on behalf of the oceans.
Yes.
And it was, in fact, Jean-Michel Cousteau's filming of much of the waters around the northwestern Hawaiian Islands that has been widely credited for turning President Bush around and inspiring President Bush to name the northwestern Hawaiian Islands Marine National Monument.
Absolutely. We were
a couple of weeks ago.
We were honored to have him on the show last week, Kara.
And isn't he incredible?
Yeah.
You know exactly what I'm talking
about.
Yes,
we do. And we've had some amazing information that came out of that interview and his support in what we're doing here. So, Kara, this dishonoring of the law, is this due to ignorance or arrogance, do you think?
Well, it's hard to say that it's due to ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
So I won't say that it's necessarily due to arrogance either. At this point, the science is very clear, and it would be impossible, I think, for the Navy to say that it does not know the harm that its mid-frequency sonar can do to marine life. Scientists are nearly universal at this point in acknowledging that at least sometimes mid-frequency sonar of the type that the Navy is proposing to use around Hawaii in the next couple of weeks can kill and injure whales and is responsible for whale strandings around the world. In 2004, for example, the International Whaling Commission Scientific Committee, which consists of some of the leading whale biologists in the world, took a look at the evidence linking mid-frequency Navy sonar with whale strandings, concluded that the evidence of that causation was overwhelming and completely convincing. Even the Navy hired some consultants to take a look at this link, and they too concluded that the link between Navy sonar and whale strandings is, quote-unquote, completely convincing. So it can't be that the Navy doesn't know the harm that its sonar sometimes does to marine life.
Uh-huh.
Importantly, that harm isn't restricted just to strandings. One of the really most troubling aspects of this problem is that, A, whales may be dying even apart from the ones that come up on the beach and the strand.
Yes.
And then, B, there's just a whole host of other behavioral and other more subtle and long-term effects that blasting the oceans with really high-intensity sound may be having on marine mammals and other marine life, such as fish and sea turtles. That's harder to study because it's just not as over-the-top and obvious as whale stranding on a beach.
From what I understand from Jean-Michel Cousteau's interview last week, he was saying that there's going to be some research information released this week in regards to certain fishing areas and particularly to the effect that the sonar has on the swim bladder of some of the fish, which will affect the economics and the food sources of the local culture here. And surely that has to be taken into major consideration also.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know specifically the research that Jean-Michel Cousteau is referencing, but over the years it's become clear that the ocean is really an acoustic environment,
mm-hmm.
and all sorts of animals in it, not just whales and marine mammals.
Mm-hmm.
Fish, which depend on swim bladders, as you said, to regulate their feeding and other behaviors, and also depend, interestingly, on sound in order to sort of find places where they want to lay their eggs, can be tremendously affected when there are high levels of noise pollution in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Seismic air guns, which are used by the oil and gas industry to locate subsea oil and gas deposits under the ocean, have been shown, for example, to reduce commercial catch rates of fish really significantly in very broad swaths of the ocean around oil and gas surveys and for days and days at a time. And this has tremendous effects on the economies and sort of the food sustainability of local communities. And that's something that the Navy just hasn't taken into account at all.
And what about National Marine Fisheries? Are they doing anything about these seismic surveys? I mean, aren't they supposed to be protecting from that, too?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Seismic surveys are another example of a kind of activity that clearly, under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, needs to be permitted before it can occur. NIMS has been a little schizophrenic on this issue. It has required permits for some seismic surveys in some waters. For example, there's a history of issuing permits for surveys in some Alaskan waters, but not, for example, for surveys in Gulf of Mexico waters. And I'm not quite sure why that is.
Interesting.
But it's very troubling that that whole swaths of, you know, of our outer continental shelf are being crisscrossed with very high intensity seismic surveys without any sort of permitting or overview from NIMFS.
Well, I really hope that NIMFS can get back in line and in integrity with what Congress have actually had, you know, have them there to do, because otherwise, what's the point of even having this agency?
Yeah, well, you know, NIMFS is in a very difficult position, and I don't want to paint them as, you know, as certainly not as bad people. They are under tremendous pressure from regulated industries, tremendous pressure from the Navy and from the oil and gas industry, and they're often put in a tough spot. But I certainly agree with you that their job is to enforce these laws, and we often call on them to enforce them much more vigorously than they do now. And for that reason, NIMFS will be a defendant in our lawsuit against the Navy over RIMPAC 2006, if indeed we wind up filing it.
Wow, okay. Now, Kara, we're looking at hosting 8 nations in these military war games in Hawaii for tomorrow. Obviously, this is a global issue, not just a local issue to Hawaii. So what are your feelings and the other attorneys with NRDC on this? And does the Marine Mammal Protection Act protect all marine mammals worldwide, or is it just in the United States?
That's a great question, because this really is a worldwide issue. The U.S. Navy is just one of many navies with this mid-frequency sonar technology.
Uh-huh.
The Marine Mammal Protection Act protects marine mammals from harm from U.S. citizens and U.S. agencies, such as the U.S. Navy, wherever that harm occurs. So in our view, if the Navy were to go off into the high seas somewhere and undertake an exercise that has potential to harm marine mammals, even if that exercise isn't in U.S. waters, the Navy has to get a permit.
Mm-hmm.
And engage with NIMFS because of the protections in the Marine Mammal Protection Act. But other navies are certainly free to use their sonar in a way that's harmful to marine mammals without regard to U.S. law protections. And so it becomes a matter of really pressuring other nations domestically to get a hold of this problem and enact protections similar to those that the U.S. has enacted. And then also an issue for international law.
Mm-hmm.
I was at a meeting at the United Nations last week, for example, dealing with the law of the sea. And one of the things we were talking about at that meeting with all sorts of different countries was the fact that high-intensity sound is a form of pollution under the law of the sea.
Yes.
And therefore triggers all sorts of requirements under international law for countries to reduce pollution, to reduce high-intensity noise in the oceans. This is an area where there needs to be a lot of work done because I think most countries don't have this problem in mind as they regulate activities on the oceans.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that after the Canary Islands had the tragic string of whale strandings, which were again linked to Navy sonar exercises, the Spanish Ministry of Defense announced a prohibition on all active sonar exercises. Is this the only country that's taken a stand to protect and shelter these sensitive species?
Well, the Spanish example is a really good one. Spain has borne the brunt of several of these strandings that have occurred in the Canary Islands, which is Spanish territory, and therefore is more awake to this notion and to this problem than I think many other countries around the world. And its action was really extraordinary. It did prohibit sonar use within, I think, 50 nautical miles of the Canary Islands, though not anywhere. So it wasn't a total prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
It was a localized prohibition, given the evidence that sonar use in this area tends to cause strandings. They'd had a series of strandings there, one after another, maybe 6 or so from the 1980s, even up to as recently as 2004. So that action was really commendable on their part.
Yes.
And should be looked to by other countries as an example of a way to achieve national security but also protect our oceans by prohibiting sonar in places where it seems like it would be particularly dangerous to use it because of concentrations of marine mammals.
Like the Hawaiian Islands right here.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What are other countries doing to protect their marine mammals from this noise pollution?
I don't really know that there are other good examples out there of countries that are acting aggressively to protect marine mammals from sonar. But there are a couple of examples we can point to. One is the Australian Navy, which has been much more protective of marine mammals during sonar training exercises of the type that the Navy is proposing to undertake in Hawaii next week. I'll give you an example. The Navy next week is proposing to employ a safety zone around its ships of just 660 feet, or about 200 meters. And only if marine mammals are sighted within that very small distance around its transiting ships will it turn off its sonar. By contrast, the Australian Navy employs a safety zone of 4,000 yards, which is much bigger. It's almost 4 kilometers.
Yes.
As compared to the just 200 meters of the U.S. Navy. So the Australian Navy, at least, has recognized that when it's training with sonar, it has to be really proactive and protective of marine mammals in a way that's much more aggressive than the U.S. Navy stands.
That's really weak of the U.S. Navy to give to do this 660 feet compared to the 15 miles that the sonar actually stretches out to.
Yeah, it's incredible, and it really doesn't comport with the science of impacts and the science showing sort of at what high levels the sonar noise can propagate,
right,
especially in conditions that, like conditions that are sometimes common in Hawaii, known as surface ducting conditions, where levels of sound reach out into the ocean very, very far, as you said, for miles and miles.
Yes, and what about the fact that the sonar is not just going above the ocean or on top of the ocean, it's going down into the ocean, and they're just viewing what's going on 660 feet above the ocean? That's so lame.
Yeah, well, part of the problem is, of course, one that you identify here. The Navy is looking for marine mammals at the surface of the ocean, 660 feet from its ships.
Mm-hmm.
But we all know that marine mammals spend only a fraction of their time at the surface of the ocean.
Uh-huh.
So what about all of the ones that we're not seeing?
Yeah.
And even by the Navy's own admission, its monitoring protocol, which will basically consist of one sailor on a transiting ship, who has other duties as well, not just to look for marine mammals. You know, using a pair of binoculars and looking out all around the ship for marine mammals will succeed only about 5% of the time in seeing marine mammals that are there. Really not a very effective monitoring means. And this is one of the things that we're calling on the Navy to improve.
Yes, absolutely. This isn't really monitoring, is it? It's not really monitoring.
No, and in fact, the U.S. Marine Mammal Commission, which is a group of scientists and experts that's been appointed by the U.S. Congress to help in the protection of marine mammals and the implementation of the Marine Mammal Protection Act, agrees on this very point, as well as several others that we've made today, and has sent a letter to the Navy saying, you know what, this monitoring is not sufficient. Even by your own account, it will only see about 5% of marine mammals, and you really have to beef it up. As far as we can tell, the Navy hasn't responded to that letter.
Oh. Well, yeah, I read in the Soundings of the Depths, too, that in 2004, the administration formed a working group made up of officials from wildlife agencies, Marine Mammal Commission, and various branches of government that used high-intensity noise in the sea. What has been the progress of this group to date?
I believe you're talking about a working group that was convened to discuss international regulation. Undersea noise, is that right?
I'm not sure whether it was international or also in the U.S.
Yeah, if we're talking about the same one, the U.S. did convene a working group of U.S. administrative agencies to formulate U.S. policy with respect to international regulation of undersea noise.
Mm-hmm.
And its conclusions were really very troubling. The U.S. has taken a stance on undersea noise that is very similar to its stance on climate change so far. Not surprisingly,
uh-huh.
It's their view that the science isn't there yet, just like with climate change, that there's no need for international regulation of this issue, just like with climate change. And they've therefore taken the position that the U.S. will oppose any international regulation of undersea noise, which, in our view, is shows just a really clear lack of vision and lack of leadership on this issue that's inexcusable.
It seems that looking through your documents that there's been so many treaties and agreements made, but the United States really haven't applied themselves to them.
Yeah, the Law of the Sea is a really good example.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, I was at the UN last week, and I would say 10 or so countries, or maybe even more, around the room continually called for a discussion of undersea noise in the context of the law of the sea and emphasized the importance of this issue internationally. And the U.S.'s position at that meeting was consistently to say that they didn't believe that the meeting should be talking about the issue of undersea noise, and they firmly and vehemently were opposed to including any language on undersea noise in the ultimate documents coming out of the meeting, which was a very disappointing position for the U.S. to take.
Absolutely. Now, normally the Navy would have to provide an environmental impact statement to NOAA, but instead they've only submitted an environmental assessment. Can you tell us what the difference is and why haven't the Navy complied with these regulations?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the real bedrock federal environmental protections we have comes in a law called NEPA, or the National Environmental Policy Act. And what this real revolutionary law said was that before federal actors undertake major actions that may significantly affect the environment, they have to take a look at these effects and make sure that they understand and publicize so that the public understands the environmental effects of these actions before a decision is made about whether to take these actions, so that everyone can make an informed decision about whether or not it's worth it, given the environmental effects.
Mm-hmm.
And the statement that is required in the law that does these things is the environmental impact statement.
Mm-hmm.
And only if the Navy concludes that this exercise will have no significant impacts can it avoid undertaking this environmental impact statement. Now, if you take a look at the scale and the scope of the proposed RIMPAC exercise and the use of sonar in that exercise, which will encompass 44 individual sonar exercises over the course of 4 weeks over an area of some of the most biologically rich waters that, you know, that exist in the U.S.,
yes,
over 210,000 square nautical miles and over 530 hours of high-intensity mid-frequency sonar use, the thought that this type of action could not possibly have a significant environmental impact is, in our view, ridiculous. But
yes,
this is the stance that the Navy has taken. And that's its excuse for not undertaking the environmental impact statement, which is the sort of full review required.
And they've had, since 2004, to respond to the strandings we've had here in Hanalei Bay, which is what we're very concerned about, another exposure of that disaster. So they've had the time to prepare the environmental impact statement, conduct a proper analysis, alternative analysis, and bring its biennial exercise into genuine compliance with the law. But it didn't do any of those things. Now, NOAA needs to obviously take a stand, and it's not taking a stand. The National Marine Fisheries, they're not taking a stand. Does this mean that without a lawsuit, we're not going to see any action taken for anything that they do?
Well, you know, it's our view that we would prefer to avoid litigation if we can reach an understanding with the Navy and with NOAA about what steps need to be taken to protect whales and dolphins and other marine life during the exercise. But I have to say, we've written the Navy and NIMS many letters over the past several years, and then many letters in the last 30 days, emphasizing the importance, in our view, of getting this exercise right, of putting the right protective measures in place. And we've not really gotten a satisfactory response from the Navy or from NIPS.
Mm.
So I'm beginning to fear that litigation will be required. So we'll see when the ultimate permit is published in the next couple of days.
Yes.
Protective measures are in it.
Oh, that's going to be exciting. When have NRDC taken the Navy to court in the past? Have you?
We have a bit of a history.
What was the result? I'd like to know when, and you know, if you could give us a bit
sure.
of background on
it. Actually, a sort of interesting story how the NRDC got involved in this issue of undersea noise pollution, and especially intense undersea noise caused by the Navy. The Navy, about 10 years ago, had proposed to undertake something called a ship shock trial near the Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary, which is a national marine sanctuary off the coast of Southern California that's home to a real variety of marine life, tremendously diverse marine life. Nonetheless, the Navy proposed to undertake basically a series of explosions, of undersea explosions, to test the strength of their ships.
Oh.
right near this National Marine Sanctuary.
Amazing.
We took them to court in 1994 over this, saying this is absolutely the wrong place to undertake these sorts of tests, and you need to do an environmental impacts assessment statement looking at other places where you can do this sort of testing because this is inappropriate right near the National Marine Sanctuary. We won that case, and the district court agreed with us and said, absolutely, you know, national security is very important, but the Navy needs to choose the right place to be undertaking these tests, and this doesn't look like it. In the course of this case, we've been looking at all sorts of impacts that such explosions might have on the National Marine Sanctuary, and we weren't originally looking at undersea noise as one of those main impacts, but our experts told us that this was indeed one of the key concerns, and that's really what turned us on to the question of undersea noise. That had us beginning to look at Navy sonars in addition. And in 2001, we brought another case against the Navy challenging the Navy's decision to deploy worldwide a new kind of sonar called low-frequency active sonar, or LFA sonar, throughout 75% of the world's oceans without adequate environmental review, without an adequate permit under the MMPA, and disturbingly, without a really clear sense of what this new sonar technology would do to the marine environment and to whales and dolphins. Again, we told the court that, in our view, their environmental compliance was inadequate. They were not proposing to take protective measures sufficient to ensure that they wouldn't be having significant adverse impacts on, you know, whales and dolphins around the world. And without undertaking those actions and complying with federal law, it was just wrong that they proposed to use the sonar throughout 75% of the world's oceans. And once again, the court agreed with us, issued an injunction, and told the Navy that it couldn't use its sonar in the way it proposed unless it complied with federal law.
So you've had some good success then taking them to court.
Yeah, you know, like as I said, we try to negotiate with the Navy whenever we can. Litigation is not our first choice. It's often, in fact, our last choice. We have a history, when we bring the Navy to court, of winning, which is one of the reasons why I think they take us seriously. When we tell them that we're considering challenging RIMPAC 2006 quite seriously, and we hope that they make the right decision about mitigation measures in that exercise.
Now, Kara, if this report that you get or this permit that you get is not in compliance with what is in integrity, are you going to be able to stop them before they go ahead and deploy the sonar, or are you going to have to take them to court? And I mean, can you stop it temporarily?
Yeah. So what's likely to happen is, as you know, the exercise itself is scheduled to begin tomorrow. So there's not a lot of time.
No.
But as we understand it, the sonar portion of the exercise is not likely to begin until July 5th or so, the following week. So if necessary, we're prepared to go into court and ask for a temporary restraining order, or TRO, that would prevent the use of sonar while the court looks at some of our claims.
Fantastic. What help do you need from that basis from the public?
Great question. I think it's really important for the public to get involved in this issue. Whenever comment letters from people who are really passionate about protecting our oceans and the wildlife in them come to decision makers in Congress or come to the Navy, it really makes such a difference. And just, I think, emphasizes for decision makers how important these issues are and the fact that the Navy can no longer ignore the mounting evidence of harm. So I think that the most important thing that folks listening to this radio show can do is contact your representatives, your senators, and the Navy itself. And I'd be happy to give you, after this interview, some addresses that you can send
please,
out.
Because we'll continue to run this show for another hour after our interview, and we will give out that information on the air.
Yeah, absolutely. And send letters, letting them know how outraged you are that these sorts of activities are being proposed for Hawaii's incredibly rich waters, especially in light of President Bush's designation of the Marine National Monument just two weeks ago.
Absolutely. And we will have, and in fact, on my website, which is www.drannwest.com. We have a page there under Whales and Dolphins with all of our state officials, congressmen, all of their email addresses. All they have to do is go to my website and boom, it's all there. They can write their letters.
That's really great, and it really does make a difference.
Fantastic. Oh, well, this is great news. This is good to know that we can help you somehow in this way. Now, there was an agreement on the conservation of cetaceans of the Black Sea, Mediterranean Sea, and the Atlantic area. Maybe you could tell us about how that came into being and what help has it been to protect marine mammals from noise pollution? And, again, is the U.S. a part of this agreement?
Yeah. So this is an agreement that is called, for short, ACOBAMS.
Uh-huh.
Of conservation of cetaceans of the Black and Mediterranean Sea, but ACOBAMS is much shorter. And the U.S. is not a party to it, but wouldn't be expected to be a party to it, since it's an agreement mostly of countries surrounding the Mediterranean and Black Seas in Europe who decided to get together and work cooperatively for the protection of their cetaceans, their whales.
Mm-hmm.
And they've made tremendous strides. I think they're a model for other regional seas agreements and other international agreements with respect to undersea noise. Their scientific committee has looked at the question and has issued a resolution on the importance of undersea noise, the importance of countries working cooperatively to control undersea noise from sources like military sonar and oil and gas exploration and shipping and other sources.
Mm-hmm.
And their scientific committee is actually now working on a set of guidelines that would be used by all countries surrounding the Mediterranean Black Seas in their regulation of parties that generate undersea noise.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really a first that I know of, that different countries are working together to come up cooperatively with a common set of guidelines for the protection of undersea noise. It's really a step in the right direction.
Fantastic. Now, the Convention on the Law of the Sea was ratified by almost 150 countries representing the will of the vast majority of the people of the world, and yet not the United States. What steps do you think should be taken to bring the U.S. into integrity with this issue?
Yeah, the U.S. should clearly ratify the Law of the Sea. Even if the U.S. does not ratify the Law of the Sea, so many countries have ratified the Law of the Sea and follow its that the Law of the Sea has become at this point what's known as common law, which means it's so widely accepted that all countries are required and obliged to follow it, even if they haven't signed it themselves. So this is what made, in my view, the U.S.'s action at the Law of the Sea meeting at the U.N. this week particularly disturbing, because the U.S. is under obligations, just like every other country,
mm-hmm.
to treat undersea noise, harmful undersea noise, as a form of pollution seriously, and it simply failed to do so.
Uh-huh. The NRDC has recommended that Congress create a federal program for coordinating research. What are you hoping this will achieve in the big picture?
Well, part of the problem in the sort of world of undersea noise and marine mammal research is that the Navy itself is one of the largest funders of marine mammal research in the United States, which makes it difficult for some scientists to come out and then criticize the Navy's stance.
Yes, we found that out.
To its own actions, mm-hmm. and the impact that those actions are having on marine mammals, because it's hard, of course, to bite the hand that feeds you.
Absolutely.
One of the things that we've called for is the creation of an independent agency through which funding can be funneled to marine mammal scientists to study these issues that would then free up these scientists to be
honest.
Completely unconflicted and honest.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that they're not honest now, but really mm-hmm. they are under a form of conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it difficult for them.
Right.
With an independent funding agency, we think a lot of this difficulty could be resolved.
Yes, I think that's a great idea. They also recommend that Congress add a citizen suit to the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Can you tell us what this is and what it'll do?
Oh, sure. Well, you're really getting into the legal arcana here, aren't you?
Yeah, we want to know. We want to know the facts.
So right now, some environmental statutes, for example, the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, allow citizens to go into court themselves to enforce the provisions of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act.
Uh-huh.
The Marine Mammal Protection Act doesn't have an equivalent provision. So that means that when, for example, a private actor like an oil and gas company seismic explorer in the Gulf of Mexico undertakes seismic exploration and disturbs or kills marine mammals in the Gulf of Mexico in violation of the Marine Mammal Protection Act, we have to sit back as citizens and wait for the National Marine Fisheries Service, or NMFS, to do something about it. We can't take that private actor into court ourselves, allege violations of the MMPA, the way we could if that actor were violating, for example, the Clean Air Act.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, we are limited to challenging federal actors like the Navy and NMFS under the MMPA, not private actors.
Mm-hmm.
So in our view, we could make up for some of the sort of regulatory laxity that you and I talked about earlier in the program.
Mm-hmm.
We can pick up the slack for NMFS in a way. You know, NMFS is a very busy agency.
Right.
It can't keep its eye on everything.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we would love to be able to help it out when we can, pick out, in our view, the worst violators of the Marine Mammal Protection Act and bring them to court for NMFS in a way it would be doing the agency a favor.
Fantastic. Well, that's definitely something for us to keep our focus on and to go for. Now, who else is the regulator of NMFS? I mean, you're watching out over them, but is there any other agency that they actually have to answer to?
Yeah, well, of course they answer to Congress.
Okay.
So, because Congress is the lawmaker.
Okay.
And when Congress tells NMFS that it's not doing a good enough job, NMFS listens, which is part of the reason why it's so important for listeners to contact their congressional representatives.
Yes. Yes.
And tell them how they feel about both what the Navy's doing and what NMFS is doing and NMFS is not doing with respect to undersea noise.
Yes.
Protecting whales.
Yes, so it's back to Congress again.
Right.
So ultimately, building awareness of these issues that we've discussed today will feed the political will for change. That's what we're hoping for. I also feel that we've got a race against time, you know, that we're because so much is happening, as you're saying, you know, even NMFS can't keep their eye on everybody. So calling the public to act is probably one of the most powerful things that we can be doing right now, I think.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's why your radio show is so important. And I think that's one of the sort of hidden benefits, actually, of the 2004 Melon-Headed Stranding incident, in association with RIMPAC 2004, which was, of course, a tragedy. Fortunately, not as much of a tragedy as it could have been if some really brave members of the Hanalei Kohi Club and others hadn't stepped in and helped.
Mm-hmm.
But the incident overall really did, I think, help to raise the profile of the Navy's use of sonar in and around Hawaiian waters and the potential dangers of that use of sonar in a pretty helpful way,
yeah.
In a way that has now forced the Navy to deal with this issue much more forthrightly than it has in the past.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think the whales coming out and asking for help did it.
The other thing that people around Hawaii should be aware of is that the Navy's use of sonar in Hawaiian waters is not limited to the RIMPAC exercise. The Navy has a standing operations area that's about 210,000 square nautical miles and encompasses all of the waters around the Hawaiian Islands. And to the best of our knowledge, conducts mid-frequency sonar training in these waters throughout the year, not on the scale or the size of the RIMPAC exercises, certainly, but frequently and, in our view, unlawfully, because they do so without getting any permit under the MMPA. So this is something else for people to be aware of and to write their congressman about.
Is that happening right now, do you think?
Well, right now I think the Navy's focus is on RIMPAC. But I'm sure it happens throughout the year. I couldn't tell you how many times a year it happens. But the Navy certainly does mid-frequency sonar exercises in its Hawaiian Islands operations area outside the RIMPAC exercise and without permits from NMFS under the MMPA.
So that's definitely something that we should be writing to Congress about, as you're saying.
Absolutely.
To remind them of that.
Talking to people about and just, you know, getting up in arms about.
Well, we've got flyers going out and obviously the broadcast, and we've got you know, information that we're trying to put out as much as possible. I know that you would also like to, because we're near the end of the show, I know that you would like to share some information with us regarding the International Whaling Commission at St. Kitts. Can you possibly give us an update of the final decisions that were made there last week?
Sure, absolutely. Well, the good news is that the moratorium on commercial whaling remains in place.
Yay!
Some of the press coming out of the meeting was a little confusing because Japan did, and here's the bad news, Japan did arrive at the meeting for the first time with a majority of countries willing to support the eventual disassembling of that moratorium, which is disturbing news, but the moratorium remains in place because a simple majority of countries is not enough. Instead, you need three-quarters of the countries to vote to end the moratorium before the moratorium will end. So the good news is the moratorium remains in place. Uh-huh. Another piece of good news out of the meeting is that the Scientific Committee of the International Whaling Commission recognized seismic survey noise, the sort of noise that we talked about earlier in the program that's created when oil and gas companies explore for oil and gas using seismic air guns, is a growing problem for marine mammals, and they made a series of recommendations about research to be done and mitigation measures to be undertaken to protect whales from seismic survey noise, which is great. The other thing that people should know coming out of the meeting is that it's more important than ever to pressure the U.S. government to stand firm on behalf of the moratorium on commercial whaling, because I think efforts to undo that moratorium will just pick up from this point forward.
Yes.
Japan has gotten a little bit of momentum, and it's really important for us to stop them here.
Yes, yes, they definitely. What other countries were supporting this whaling?
Japan has recruited in recent years a series of Pacific Island countries.
Iceland was one of them, wasn't it?
And then in addition, there are other whaling countries such as Iceland and Norway.
Uh-huh.
So there's a series of countries that conduct whaling themselves, Iceland, Norway, and Japan being the most prominent.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a series of countries that have been recruited by these, sometimes potentially in association with development grants or other funding from these countries,
mm-hmm.
in order to vote with the pro-whalers at the IWC.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for giving us this information about the International Whaling Commission, because we've all been kind of wondering and waiting to get the actual end results. You've been an excellent guest today, Kara. Your information has been really, really interesting and powerful and very useful to us. Do you have the addresses that you would like to give us for the Navy or Congress or anybody that you want us to write letters to?
I don't have them with me. Can I call you back?
Yes, you absolutely can. And we can give those out in a little while on the air. We'll just... We'll keep that open for now. Is there anything else you would like to share with all of our listeners today, that any way that we can be of assistance to NRDC?
Well, again, I just want to thank all of your listeners for caring so much about whales and dolphins and the marine life around Hawaii, to let them know that we're doing what we can to make sure that marine life around Hawaii is protected, and to encourage you guys, again, just to keep up the good fight.
Fantastic. We would love to know what goes on with those, with the permit. So maybe we could talk about, in a couple of days when you get that permit and what happens with that. So maybe we could talk about that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'd be happy to do that.
Okay, fantastic. Kara, thank you so much. Good luck with everything you're doing, and God bless you all for doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much, Dr. West. It was great talking to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was a most amazing interview, and I've got Margaret right here. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Anne. How are you?
Very good. And Mel Sandler. Hey, Mel.
Hey.
Well, ladies, I think Kara was one of the most dynamic speakers we've had on the show, on this series up to now.
Well, she certainly is on top of the issues with sonar, and I think NRDC is going to do a great job, and I hope that we get some communication and some kind of movement from NIMS and the Navy before they actually do start RIMPAC.
Well, the great thing is to find out that they can actually put a restraining order on if they have to, if this permit is not in compliance with what they've already asked them to do.
That'll be interesting to see what happens in the next probably 72 hours.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I think that hopefully that will go straight up to the Federal Register. Something that everybody can just enter NOAA or NMFS when you get to the Federal Register webpage and see if it's come up.
What do you the the response to the permit, you mean, from NIMFS?
Yeah, I think it'll be posted right away.
Do we have any phone numbers, contact numbers for our public, our listeners?
Well, I was just at the Stranding meeting on Friday, which is a new group that's been developed by NIMFS. Before that, it was the Hawaiian Island Stranding Response Group, which was a volunteer organization, nonprofit, started by Dr. Bob Braun, Marley Breeze, and Paul Nautical. Really great people who were very instrumental in what happened in Honolulu Bay.
Yes.
But that's just been disbanded. NIMFS has come out and created their own Hawaiian Islands Responding Network.
Is it a strong network?
No, they're just really starting out. And so what came of the meeting...
It's a little late to be starting out. Here.
Well, David Schofield is in charge. And at the meeting Friday, we had a North Shore type of group.
Mm.
The essence of which is that he gave me a short, maybe 5-minute discussion about monitoring during because of RIMPAC, that would be fine if we got people in the community to do watchful observations. He's really concerned because it'll be up to him to stop RIMPAC based on what he sees. So it's important that we all be good stewards of the ocean and take the responsibility this time between June 26th and July 28th to observe what's going on around us, anything that's different, any kind of animals, any kind of documentation. His cell phone number, which is what everyone has been given right up to now, is 808-721-5343. Everyone should get a pencil and write this down. David Schofield is the NOAA Regional Office head of the Hawaiian Marine Mammal Stranding Response Network. I was one of the people who was at that meeting because the organization, the Honolulu Canoe Club, was part of the response team that happened in 2004. So we will then be becoming some kind of larger network on the North Shore. Also, there's an 800 number which we have posted on Ann's website, but it's also important to have, and we will be having flyers out. That number is 1-888-256-9840. I was also given some other information. He talked about this group as an incidental command structure for the Hawaii Marine Mammal Stranding Response Network that was made up of Bob Braun and Greg Levine, who are veterinarians who are experts who will be part of this network. The state partners are DNLR, DAR, which is Department of Aquatic Resources, the Monk Seal Stranding Group, the Hawaiian Islands Humpback Whale Marine Sanctuary, that's all part of this team, the U.S. Coast Guard, the Navy, and the Army. Also, Sea Life Park, which will be involved in anything that's a live stranding, and Hawaii Pacific University, which is going to set up a necropsy lab for any animals.
Dead animals.
Yes. Exactly. So that's the network, and then at a community level, it's a handful of us trying to do something. But I think through this show, we've been able to educate, as Jean-Michel says, and increase the awareness.
Yeah.
And I think NRDC is doing their job for us, and if we can get people to write their congressmen and talk about these issues...
Then we're moving somewhere.
Yes.
Obviously, that's the main thing. Mel, why don't you give out the information for hotline numbers for any sightings...
Right.
Distressed.
Yeah, we just want to remind everybody to keep their eyes open for large animals in shallow water, rapid changes in direction and speed, erratic swimming patterns, prolonged diving or surfacing, straight line formations. And if you see any of this type of activity, please get out of the way, turn off your engine. If you can, safely get your props out of the water because they might not be able to hear your engines. Mark your location on your GPS. Note the time and direction of travel. Estimate the speed and the pod size. And give me a call at 652-3392. Again, that number is 652-3392.
Call David Schofield on his cell phone, 808-721-5343. That is directly to David Schofield's cell phone that sits on his hip. So when you see something, call that number and Mel's number immediately. We need to record everything that we see.
Yes.
And if possible, you need to try to get a photograph of the ship that the sonar is being deployed from.
The more documentation...
That's what Jean-Michel told us.
Yes, the more documentation everyone has, the better and clearer communication we'll get to become more knowledgeable about what is going on. And for our own protection, it's very important that people do not go in and try to...
Interfere
with an animal at any cost. If they see something happening, they should immediately call David Schofield. That NOAA is the has the authority to deal with things, and so then they would tell us what we can do.
Mm.
So,
and we want to remind people too is to stay out of the RIMPAC areas. That information you can call PMRF. And get the dates and locations.
The thing is, though, if we're asking people to stay out of those areas, they're the areas that we may need to be looking at.
Right. As we always say, though, the animals won't know where the boundaries are. So we'll, we'll notice something far enough away from the ships that we won't put any of our boaters in harm's way.
Okay. Are you Pal?
I'm Pal.
Are you Margaret?
I think so.
Okay, thank you, ladies. And I want to note for the record that the U.S. Navy has been invited to share their opinions on this show and to date have not responded. I wonder why it's so hard for apparently intelligent people to admit to their true results of their actions and to do what is right to enhance and protect life and our environment first and foremost. I'm Dr. Ann West. You've been listening to Truth from the Source and our special series of Keepers of the Seas Call for Help. My thanks go out to my guest today, Carol Horowitz from NRDC, Margaret Wright for co-producing this series with me, and to Mel Sandler for documenting the series through film. Mahalo for all of your help. We're going to listen to some music now, again from Dr. Ann West. You've been listening to Truth.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.